We're reading this morning from Matthew 16. It's just three verses that appear on the screen there. And so just these short verses I'll read to you. From then on, Jesus began to tell his disciples plainly that he had to go to Jerusalem. And he told them what would happen to him there. He would suffer at the hands of the leaders and the leading priests and the teachers of religious law. He would be killed. He would be raised on the third day. But Peter took him aside and corrected him. "Heaven forbid, Lord," he said. "This will never happen to you." Next. But Jesus turned to Peter and said, "Get away from me, Satan. You are a dangerous trap to me. You are seeing things merely from a human point of view and not from God's." Well, just three verses there. If we go to the next slide, please. This morning, we're thinking about correct and restore. And remember, through this whole series, we are looking at how Jesus did discipleship, bringing people along with him, enabling them to grow in their faith. And he modeled that. He did life on life with this group of followers who came along with him. And they were growing through life together. And then he got to a point where he said, "Look, I'm not going to be with you anymore. You go and do the same. Get some people around you. Enable them to grow by doing life on life with them. And hopefully that'll get to a point where they can then go and do the same." In fact, that whole following Jesus together business, what we call discipleship, is fundamental to the spread and the growth of the good news, the generosity of God. People doing life on life with others. And we've been looking at how Jesus did that, and we've seen that following Jesus together means seeing the God-given potential in people. And seeing in the crowd and the melee of different people, maybe the one or two that you are called to spend more time with, to make more space available for that life-on-life stuff. And we've seen that Jesus did it very much in the context of friendship. He gathered these people around him and he became friends with them. Friends who could then ask questions, who could wrestle over points, who could tease things out together. And we've seen that it means sending people out to say, "Well, now you go and do what I've been doing. Let's switch from I do while you watching, to now you are doing while I'm watching." And then getting to that point where it's saying, well, you can go and do this and you don't need me to be hanging around anymore. You are released to go and do that. But with that, we saw that, of course, there's risk because they might go and get it wrong. They might mess it up, might fluff it. But without risk, there is no growth. And so Jesus absolutely took that risk with people and said, "Look, you go and do this." And off you go. And got them to come and reflect back. And we looked at that cycle of learning, seeing things together, and then being sent off, and then coming back thinking about what has just happened. And all of this happens in the unfolding story of Jesus. As he does his ministry, as he goes round to villages and towns and tells people about the good news of the generosity of God, that's the environment in which the following to Jesus together happens. That's the environment in which the growing happens and the discipleship takes place. But now in the story, we come to a turning point. We come to a change of gear where in all three of what you might call the story gospels, there's four gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. John is written a little bit differently, a bit more philosophical, a bit more head in the clouds. But the first three, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, are the basic stories. In all three of those stories, there's this turning point where things suddenly change In Matthew, it's in 16. In Mark, it's chapter 8. Luke, it happens to be chapter 9. But Jesus has been ministering, he's been teaching, he's been healing. And then he gets to a point where he says, right, now we're going to go to Jerusalem. Set a course for Jerusalem. And off they go. In the reading we had this morning, Matthew 16, it says, from that time on, a turning point. Suddenly we are now going to Jerusalem. And with his friends around him closely, he spells it out and he says, look, we're going to Jerusalem and this is what is going to happen. The Son, that's me, must be arrested, must suffer and die, but will be raised again on the third day. Well, Peter hears this and he takes Jesus aside. He says, Jesus, just come over here a minute, come over here. And says to him, no way, Jesus, you've got the wrong script. That's not what it's going to be like. It can't happen. You can't have that happen to you. You can't suffer and die. You're wrong on that point. Well, question for us, firstly. Should we find Peter's reaction so surprising? I mean, think about it. Peter and the others, they've seen Jesus minister. They've seen Jesus declare the kingdom of God. They've seen blind people receive their sight. They've seen people afflicted with demons and all kinds of other bad stuff set free, and all the demons have gone and they've been freed and it's been fantastic. They've seen Jesus talk about the kingdom of God and wonderful things have happened. They've got the idea that Jesus is this anointed person of God who has come to put things right once and all. They've got the idea that he is the chosen Messiah, their technical word in their culture and language, for the anointed one of God to come and rescue. But in their thinking, the Messiah is indeed the anointed one of God. He's a mighty warrior. And he will come and he will go to Jerusalem to kick the Romans, who are the occupying force, the bad power, kick them out once and for all, and restore the nation of Israel back to how it should be. And they've got Old Testament scriptures to back that up. They can turn to the prophets and say, yes, warrior king, who is going to do this for us. And so, having twigged that Jesus is this anointed one, to then have him say, well, actually, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and I'm going to be arrested and killed, doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense. Have Matthew 16 open. Just look back a few verses. We picked it up at 21, but go back to verse 16. And Jesus says to them, look, who do people say I am? And there's a few comments, there's a few ideas. And then Peter says, you're the Messiah. You're the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, you've got it. Bang on. You've twigged it. You've realized. Well done. So how can they go from you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God, through to I'm going to go to Jerusalem and be killed and died in just six verses? No wonder they were confused. But see the closeness of friendship that Jesus has with Peter and the other disciples that enables Peter to take Jesus aside and have this word with him. This closeness of friendship that even provides space for Peter to rebuke Jesus. I mean, who of us would think of rebuking Jesus? But Peter's got this closest relationship. He thinks he can do that. Okay, he might be mistaken, but at least he thinks he can do that. How special is that? But then read on to verse 23 and Jesus' response. Get behind me, Satan. That's nice. Not. That's harsh words. That's not wrapping Peter in a nice softy cotton wool blanket cuddly thing. That's him turning around and saying, Peter, you've got it. absolutely wrong. Well, was their relationship strong enough to take that kind of thing? Again, back in verse 16, 17, Peter declares Jesus as the Son of God. And Jesus affirms him for it. Jesus says, look, that's inspiration from the Father. In other words, you are speaking inspired by the Spirit of God to realize that and speak that out. That's a wonderful thing. And he says other wonderful things for Peter at the same time. But now, verse 23, he's like saying, no, Peter, you're speaking the words of Satan, the evil one. It's like evil incarnate here through your mouth. That's quite a swing. To go from inspired by the Spirit of God to speaking the very words of a devil in six verses. That's a big turnaround. And that raises a huge, huge question of our understanding of God and of people and the world and the way things work. Is it possible for a follower of Jesus to one minute be speaking inspired by the Spirit of God and another minute be speaking the words of the devil himself? Is that possible? Huge question. It'll take a whole nother sermon. We can't unpack it all now. But in this passage, the answer seems to be yes, it is possible. And in my own observation and wrestling and seeing times where I've seen opposition from Christians to what seems to be a great work of God or move of God, my answer for myself is actually yes as well. It is possible. Don't understand it, can't get my head around it, but that's my own observation. At the very least, we should admit that we are not immune to getting things so, so wrong from time to time. But that in itself raises another couple of questions. There's lots of questions this morning. Can we learn to tell the difference? Can we learn to tell the difference between inspired by the Spirit of God and inspired by something else? The second question, which actually I think is more important than the question for this morning, when we detect the bad, what do we do about it? How do we deal with it as a community of followers of Jesus? See, reading on, verse 24 onwards, with Jesus, it seems like business as usual. He goes on to teach the disciples some more stuff, albeit about the way of the cross and all that. But then after that, he says, right, let's go and go on the journey. Yes, it's towards Jerusalem, but along the way, more ministering, more declaring the kingdom of God, more demonstrating the kingdom of God, more people get healed, tells people more about the kingdom of God. It's all wonderful stuff. Business as usual. It goes on. And he takes Peter with him. He doesn't say, Peter, you're going to have to stay behind. You've fouled this up. You've got it wrong. You've got Satan coming out your mouth. You're going to have to stay behind. You just stay there and don't say anything anymore. No, Peter comes with him and does all this kingdom stuff with Jesus on the way to Jerusalem. The relationship is still there. In fact, Jesus still trusts in him. In Luke's version of the story, there gets to a point once they're in Jerusalem, or very near it, where Jesus says direct to Peter, he says, look, Peter, I can see that Satan's got it in for you. Satan wants to munch you over, but I am going to pray for you to get through this. And then, of course, we know the story. We'll rehearse it in a few weeks' time, a Good Friday, Easter, where Jesus is arrested. He is tortured, brutalized, and eventually killed. But from that moment of arrest, it's now Peter's big moment to stick by his Lord, his teacher. And of course, what does he do? He fluffs it. absolutely fluffs it, doesn't get a good word out, denies Jesus, denies that he was ever there, denies that he ever knew him. But if we know the story, after that, Jesus, of course, is killed on the cross, put in the tomb, raised on the third day, starts meeting the disciples, and then John writes it up in his account. John 21, this wonderful episode of the risen Lord walking with the disciples on the beach, and Jesus reinstates Peter. Says, yes, you are the one to be taking a lead amongst the leaders to help get this work spreading across the region. Take care of the people. Do the kind of stuff that you've seen me doing. And reinstates him. So, in the big picture, these words of Jesus in verse 23, get behind me, Satan, I suggest are, well, they're harsh words. They're part of the big picture of Jesus loving, wanting to correct and restore. If you remember nothing else from this morning, remember this one thing. Jesus' desire is always to correct and restore. He always wants to do that. No matter what mess we make of things, no matter how we get it wrong, no matter how much we fluff it up, Jesus will want to find a way of correcting us and restoring us. Following Jesus together, doing life on life, needs a loving approach where correcting and restoring can happen. Because we won't always get it right. In fact, I can guarantee you that sometimes we will get it wrong. But can we be a community of following Jesus together where correcting and restoring can happen? Now, just think a minute. If we're going to correct, that is going to need challenge. That is going to need confronting some stuff. You can't correct by just leaving something bad as it is. You have to correct it. And that will mean challenging stuff and confronting it. But let's learn a way of doing it where it doesn't, we don't do that by squashing someone and putting someone down, but finding a way to get them back together, to build them back up, to put them back on track. A couple of sessions ago, but the key question, which is still on the front of a news sheet, it goes on the web, on the blog, each time one's posted. What does Jesus want to challenge in you? We've got stuff in us that needs correcting and restoring. What does Jesus want to challenge in you? Often the way that he will do that is through other people. Do you have trusted friendships that make that possible? A relationship is the best context for that to happen effectively. Sometimes it can happen out of the blue or from left field, and that's fine. But generally speaking, relationship is the best context for that. In the blokes group on Monday, actually, we were wrestling with this question from another angle about things going on in the workplace, and when you see something in a colleague that isn't right, and should you challenge that, or how do you challenge that? And we toyed with that, and we wrestled with the idea that maybe there's a principle that the more relationship you have with someone, the deeper the relationship, the better able you will be able to lovingly challenge that person. The deeper the relationship, the better able you will be able to challenge that person. Remember what we said a few weeks ago when we were looking at this friendship aspect of discipleship. The friendship makes good conditions for growth. Good conditions for growth. So that's why here we're encouraging people to get themselves into partnerships or triplets or just two, three, perhaps four people, where you can pray for each other, where you can trust each other to challenge each other. So if you're not in a triplet yet, or if you haven't found a prayer partner to do that, meet once, just maybe every 6 to 8 weeks or so. If you haven't found someone to do that and you're not making that a thing, then take some loving correction and restoring this morning. Get yourself into a partnership or a triplet. Find someone or a couple of people that you can do that with. But let's go back to the big picture. The way of Jesus. And that way, as he spells out in verse 24 onwards, is a way of giving up power and suffering. And as he says to Peter, you have the concerns of men, not of God, on this. How do we learn to have the concerns of God rather than the concerns of men? Let me leave you with an interesting thought, comparing this approach of the warrior king who's going to use military might and conquest to win victory versus the way of Jesus, which is going to involve arrest, death, but then resurrection and victory. Both of those ways apparently end in victory. Think about it. The warrior king, might, conquest, victory, or the way of Jesus. Both of those ways appear to end in victory, although maybe the type of victory will be different. But the path to get to that victory is completely different. Both appear to end in victory, but the path to get there is so, so different. Now, Peter's thinking was a stumbling block. It was a barrier. Because he couldn't see past the death of Jesus to the resurrection victory that God would give. And so he could only think in terms of warrior king who would beat everyone else up and be victorious and might and bring victory. He couldn't see past this idea that Jesus was giving him, that Jesus would die. He couldn't see past that. And that became a stumbling block. We are called to think different. We are called to fix our eyes on Jesus, who we now know is already arrested, dead, buried, but risen. And therefore already in victory. So let us think different and fix our eyes on him, but recognize that our path to go towards him in that place of already victory may well be a path of suffering and hardship and a difficult road to get there. Another way of looking at it is to think of two current day characters who are in the news from time to time. And I'm using these characters not necessarily to get at them and to make a comment about them, but as cartoon images. You know, you read a newspaper, those political cartoons, and of course they choose something or someone and they accentuate certain features to make a point. So I'm just going to use two people in the current day news as cartoon images. You see, one way is that way of power and might and victory, and yes, we're going to squash everyone else and do our thing. My cartoon image for that would be the Donald Trump way of working. But the alternative way is of laying down power, of seeing maybe institutions have gained too much power and they need to be dismantled lovingly and laid down and taken away, that power of laying a life down and letting God then raise up. That way would be more like Pope Francis's way. Two cartoon pictures, Trump or Pope Francis. You make your mind up which way seems more like the way of Jesus that we read in the story of the Gospels. And you decide. Or sit quietly and think for a few minutes.